Hi, this is Ken McCarthy, and welcome to what I think is going to be an essential phone call interview for anybody who either uses copywriting services or writes their own copy or aspires to be a copywriter or is even a copywriter. We're going to have a lot of fun with this call, and I've been looking forward to it for a very long time. Just in the way of introduction, a little while ago I was at an event called Direct Response Titans, and it was put on and organized and sponsored by Brian Kurtz, and we had just the legends of direct response there. I mean, literally, Jay Abraham, Dan Kennedy, Greg Ranker, Joe Sugarman. I'm leaving some people out, but of course, Gary Bensavenga. Just an amazing, incredible lineup. But even as equally as amazing, in my experience, having been there, I will say that the attendees were really, really interesting people. I can't even count all the people that I met who I've been wanting to follow up with. And we're going to talk with one of them today. His name is Dan. He's a copywriter. He has a really fascinating story to tell, and we're also going to talk about copywriting. And this is going to be really useful to anybody that is looking into this as this craft to master. And I think it will even be helpful for a lot of people that are even veteran copywriters. So welcome, Dan.
Thanks, Ken. I'm very humbled by that introduction. Thank you so much.
Well, Dan's got a great story, and I boiled it down to a headline. What did I say? Surfer? Yeah, Surfer Dude. Surfer Dude. And all this is a it's the best advertisements are the true ones, you know. And this is a true headline. Surfer Dude goes from zero to control beating copy in less than 2 years from a standing start. And that is the story of our guest today, Dan. And I, as a guy that's been writing copy for a long time, I am very interested in the details of how someone who didn't even know what copywriting was writing control beating. We'll talk about what that means for those that aren't aware of it in a second. But was writing control beating copy for a major direct response publisher. That is not something that's done very often. It usually takes many years to get there. So I want to find out how he got there and what tricks he used, what tricks of the trade that we all could use to improve our copy. So Dan, could you just tell us a little about how you discovered that there was a thing called copywriting and that it had nothing to do with the Library of Congress and copywriting intellectual property? Because that's the one that tricks most people up. They think, oh, you mean you put that little circle in the C next to things on documents? So that's a weird job. No,
gotten that response on more than one occasion.
So how did you hear about it? Yeah.
Everything that you just summed up in that headline is kind of how it started. I was living in Hawaii and working for a consulting firm at the time, and really I just wanted to spend more time in the water and have a little bit more freedom with where I was living so I could get closer to the water. And incidentally, it was another surfer who introduced me to the world of copywriting. He is actually a surf photographer who lives in Bali. And we were eating lunch together one day, and I was telling him about how I was kind of thinking about what I wanted to do next in life. And he said something that was basically along the lines of, well, you know, I'm not the best photographer in all of Bali, but I get a lot of work because I've mastered the marketing aspects of it, and particularly because I write a lot of good copy for when I'm trying to sell my photos. Mm-hmm. And that was... that opened up the rabbit hole. He kind of planted that seed in my head. And I guess about 6 months later, I was finished on the contract that I was on with the consulting firm. And I literally just decided, all right, this is it. I'm a copywriter now. I had zero experience. I had never written a word of copy. I had never tried to get a client.
Had you read any books about copywriting?
No, and on his suggestion, the first thing I did was I picked up Dan Kennedy's The Ultimate Sales Letter, and I tore through that, and then I wrote an ad on spec for a product that didn't even exist, and that was my first portfolio piece based on what I had read in The Ultimate Sales Letter.
Wow, so you just dove right in, no fear.
Yeah, I mean, looking back on it, exactly what you said, there was no fear when there probably should have been at least a healthy dose of realistic expectations. But, you know, I just wanted to surf, and it seemed like key to getting it done, so I went in.
You know, It's interesting that you mentioned Dan just as a sidebar, because he often used to say, I don't know how if he still mentions this to people, that sometimes one of the best advantages somebody can have in a field is they have no idea how hard it's supposed to be. They just say, oh, this field exists? Okay, I'll just do what I have to do and succeed. And only later do they wake up and go, oh, my God, that was hard.
I think there's definitely a little bit of rose-colored glasses can help in, you know, removing some of the stress that you need to really be creative. You got to be in a relaxed state, and you have to let your thinking flow. And if you know that the odds are stacked against you, it's going to be a little bit harder. I've actually found that as I've become more aware of, you know, the difficult landscape of doing what I'm doing right now, which is very hard going against other very experienced, very talented copywriters. Sometimes you get into that headspace where, you know, you're thinking that this is going to be really tough, I'm not going to do it, and that just doesn't help. You got to learn how to get out of that. And so if you never have it to begin with, I think it's an advantage.
Well, you know, it's interesting, as, you know, another sidebar I'm going to throw in. There's probably going to be a lot of sidebars in this conversation, I have a feeling. You know, we were lucky enough to hear from the guy who everybody universally acknowledges was the most effective, still is, most effective copywriter of the era. And that era goes on for a couple of decades, and that's Gary Bensavenga, of course. And it was very interesting, and everybody should know this, that Gary spent a really large amount, a large percentage of his time speaking about psychological issues, mindset issues, just what you were kind of talking about, staying loose issues. And that becomes even more significant based on what you just told me. The more you know about copywriting, the more pressured you can feel when you sit down to write. It's possible, but if you take, obviously, if you take control of your psychology, then it's not the same kind of problem.
Yeah, and I've talked to other writers who have said the exact same thing. You know, as you continue down this path, you realize that there's the whole copywriting and marketing part to it, but then on the other side of that, there's just mastering your own psychology and your own processes and learning how to absolutely squeeze every ounce of your own talent out onto the page.
Wow. And again, I think that's really one of the big messages that Gary shared at the Titan. You know, maybe we'll have a whole call on that on a future date, because it's a big topic. But let's go back to how you broke in and what helped you make progress so fast. So do you happen to recall how you got that first spec client? Now, tell people what a spec client is in case they don't know.
Well, spec is you just are writing basically without the assignment. So what I was doing at the time, I had been a fairly experienced competitive weightlifter, actually. And
really?
I had come across that was before I was a surfer, I was a weightlifter. but I had come across some fairly kind of archaic, unknown programs. And so when I went into that first spec ad, you know, I wanted to write on something I knew really well. So I just said, all right, if someone was trying to sell these kind of lost workout programs that I had discovered a few years ago, what would they say? And that's exactly what I did. I just sat down and kind of pretended I was writing to one of the guys I used to train with. You know, what would I tell him if I was trying to convince him that we needed to do this workout together? And, you know, I've read that ad a few times in the years since. It's kind of bad, but there's some parts to it that are, you know, pretty good. They show that I really knew what I needed to convey to somebody that was going to be interested in doing that.
Wow. You know, at some point in the Q&A, we're probably going to refer to the Titans meeting a lot, too, in this call. At some point during the Q&A, there was a guy who got up who is sort of a fledgling marketer. He's really new at it and hasn't really written much copy. And I think he was really concerned about, you know, how do you write, you know, how do you figure out what to write? And at some point I said to him, look, can you write a letter to a friend? And he said, yeah, I can do that. I said, okay, you can write copy. And you just pointed that out. You had a specific prospect in mind, in this case a friend who, you know, who is also familiar with working out and weights and all that. You weren't trying to write for the world. You weren't trying to write for some unseen audience. You weren't trying to write the next great American novel. You were just trying to explain to a friend why these workouts were so cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was maybe it was Paris or David Deutsch at the same Q&A said, yeah, just write to your brother or write to your dad. Just write to an actual real human being that you know. So I think that's because a lot of times you hear people say, you know, create this avatar or create the the persona of the person you're trying to write to. But I think if you're making somebody up, you're going to get tripped up on allowing some of your own biases to kind of creep in there. You know, you're essentially making a reflection of yourself. No matter how hard you try, there's going to be a little bit of your own perception of what they are supposed to hear coming through, as opposed to if you know somebody in that target market and you think about where they are, it's a lot easier to avoid that trap, I think.
Yeah, you have a good point there, and I think it also makes you a lot more sensitive, because, you know, when you're talking to a person, you kind of go, oh, that's going to bore him, or this is going to be too highfalutin, or, gee, I really didn't back this up very well, and he's kind of skeptical. So when you have a particular human being in mind, I think you tune yourself up even higher for your writing versus, oh, I'm writing to this, you know, I'm writing to the golfer, or I'm writing to the stamp collector or the surfer, you know. You're writing to, you know, John Smith, the guy that surfs every morning at 5 a.m. before work, and you're trying to persuade him, that particular person. That's a really good point.
Yeah, and I think that helps kind of tune into the various objections and the skepticism that they're going to raise. Because you can actually, at least what I'm doing, so I actually can envision this particular person saying, well, wait a minute, stop right there. You know, because you have that personality and you're thinking about it and you know what they would say if you said something that, you know, doesn't necessarily sound like it could be true or needs a little bit more proof or believability behind it.
Yep. So you took it on yourself to make up a, you know, sort of an imaginary product. Well, not imaginary. The product existed. There just wasn't a company selling it. But you said, well, I'm just going to write it. I know it's in these manuals, and I know what how good they are, and I know the audience to whom they would appeal, and I can envision a person who I'd want to present this to. And you just sat down and wrote the letter. And so you say that became your the first piece in your portfolio.
Yep, that was it.
Now, did you immediately have in mind to write for direct response, you know, sort of mail order type publishing companies?
Well, maybe not publishing companies per se, but I knew that direct response was the type of copywriting that I wanted to doing, simply because that other surfer that I just mentioned who put me onto this whole thing gave me Dan Kennedy stuff. And, you know, obviously when you read Dan Kennedy, you start to believe in the power of direct response. So I never really looked into other types of copywriting or brand copywriting, anything like that. I knew direct response was where I wanted to be.
Okay. So how did you get from writing a spec ad to create a portfolio piece to getting someone to actually give you money? Or how did you raise your skills to the point where it made sense for someone to give you money?
Well, I guess there's two answers to that question. The short answer is that immediately after that, I didn't really have any clue of what to do, so I just created a profile on Elance or Odesk or something like that, and that's where my first client came from. The caveat to that is that the clients who are paying for copywriting services on sites like that weren't necessarily paying the type of money that I needed to make a career out of it. So I learned pretty quickly that wasn't going to be the place where I was going to be finding good clients. So I got out of that game pretty quickly and kind of had to start all over again and think about ways to get clients. So I ended up getting a couple of local clients in Hawaii. I found that small businesses, brick and mortar, actual businesses in your local area generally have a pretty good need for copy, even if they don't know that what they need is copy. They just know they need marketing of some sort. And that allowed me to kind of hone my skills a little bit more. And then from there, just started working my way up the ladder and started, you know, doing a little bit more networking in the wider direct response industry, LinkedIn, sending emails. And that is kind of how I sort of broke into maybe having clients that have a little bit more recognition or a little bit more power behind their name.
Gotcha. So let me just backtrack. So the first place was Elance and Odesk and that. And I mean, the virtue, because these things just didn't exist, obviously, 20 years ago. So the negative is they don't pay well. But the virtue is if you're a raw beginner and you just want to test the waters and gain some confidence, probably not necessarily a bad place to start for a little while.
Absolutely. If I had tried to take this career on before the age of the Internet, I would have failed. I can tell you that 100%. Just because the Internet opens up so many doors, makes it a lot easier and makes the cost to enter this market essentially nil. Whereas, you know, if I were doing this 30 years ago, I wouldn't even have known where to start. That's absolutely correct. I should have prefaced what I said with that. I wouldn't go into those arenas right now, but starting out, I think it was absolutely a great place to be.
Well, you know, so many of the great copywriters, I know Eugene Schwartz, for example, he came to New York City. A lot of them come out of New York City. Why? Because that's where many of the very big mailer publishers are, and they use a tremendous amount of ad copy in a lot of catalog houses, too. And he came to New York City as a very young man, you know, in his, I think, late teens, early 20s, and all he wanted was to write the great American novel. he didn't know what advertising was either. And then he got a job, believe it or not, as a delivery boy for this this mail order house. It's terrible that I'm drawing a blank, but it's basically a three-generation mail order company. And he learned that what ad copy was, and he learned he could make money at it, and he learned he could make a lot of money. And I think Gary, I know he wanted to be a writer, and I have to check this with him, but I don't think he was even aware that such a thing as ad copywriting really existed until, you know, he just needed a job, and he wanted a job that involved writing. And so he ended up, at companies that needed people to learn direct response. So, yeah, you're right. In the olden days, you had to be in Chicago or in New York. Otherwise, you weren't really going to even hear that this art even existed. So then, to graduate out of the O-ring and or the O desk and those places, you created a LinkedIn profile, and you say you networked. So that you mentioned that involved sending cold emails to people.
So on LinkedIn, you know, you can find some job openings, and usually those job openings will be coming from, if somebody on LinkedIn is hiring for an in-house copywriter, they have a fairly consistent and important need for copy. You know, it's kind of safe to make that assumption. So that was kind of the strategy I took, is I just looked at companies that were hiring full-time in-house copywriters, and I would send them an email saying, you know, introducing myself and saying that I was a copywriter and I was interested in responding to their job opening. And I found that in most cases when they would come back to me, they would be pretty much open to, okay, well, we can pursue a full-time in-house position, or if you are more looking for freelance work, we can take that option too. Some of them wanted you to actually do a lot of freelance work and prove that you are capable of delivering before they would even throw you into the consideration for their job, their in-house position. So that actually became probably about 75% of the work that I was getting was just these job openings.
Doing freelance work for companies that were advertising for in-house direct response writers.
Exactly.
Wow, yeah, that's another thing that just didn't exist. Obviously, LinkedIn didn't exist. But, boy, that's a very elegantly clever way to find buyers of direct response copies. Because
yeah, I can't take complete credit for it. My dad actually was the one who sent me the first job posting that I looked at on LinkedIn, and that kind of sparked this thought in my head. You know, if these people are looking for full-time writers, they probably have an almost unlimited need. And so that is what started that whole process. So I have to thank my dad for that one.
Wow, that's pretty good. And then you just search. So you could search LinkedIn for all the companies that were, you know, like a keyword search, direct response.
Yeah, you know, you just type in direct response advertiser, direct response writer, direct response copywriter. And then the thing that I would add on top of that is joining some of the groups on LinkedIn or Facebook where people talk about copywriting, and they will generally have people every once in a while say, hey, you know, we're hiring for this and that.
Great. So people would take a chance on you, and what was the pay like? I mean, not necessarily exact dollars, but, you know, was it good? Were you writing on spec? In other words, writing not knowing if you're going to get paid, or how did these companies work?
I only took one job that was on contingency, and that was on the contingency that they would even run it. And by the time I got to that position, I knew that my stuff was good enough that once I turned it in that they would at least test it. But yeah, other than that, I would always negotiate an upfront fee. And a lot of times it did take some negotiation to get to the point where I felt that I was being compensated fairly. And then sometimes, you know, people are unwilling to budge. And at that point, it becomes a decision, you know, if you're not doing a project for money, is there going to be a learning experience from it, or can it add a nice part to your portfolio that might be missing in a certain industry or a certain type of writing? So there was a lot of kind of give and take sometimes when I would be closing these deals. But usually, you know, people, like I said, who have a consistent need for copy, they understand the value of copy, and they know that if you produce a really good piece that's going to create a lot of marginal revenue for them, they're going to be willing to pay you.
Yeah, that's a really nice thing about this profession is they, not, you know, obviously there's always exceptions, but generally the buyers, they're really anxious for good stuff, and they're really anxious to find really good writers. And it's kind of objective, in a, you know, I mean, everything's subjective, but there's a high degree of objectivity here. Does this writing pull orders? And I have a feeling, you know, that if you're a writer who can pull orders, you're going to get their respect.
Yeah, copywriting is the ultimate meritocracy in that regard. You know, if you've produced copy that's working, not only is the person who you've produced it for going to be coming back and asking you for it, but anybody who finds out that you've done that for somebody else is going to be looking for you too. I found that there tended, for me at least, there was kind of a tipping point where after I wrote, I think it was about 2 pieces for the company that I'm working for now, and that they sort of spread throughout, or I was able to promote myself a little bit as saying, hey, well, I actually was the one who wrote that. After that, I didn't really ever have to look for work. People were coming to me, or all it would take was me sending a quick email saying, hey, I'd like to chat. And they'd say, oh, yeah, that'd be great. And, you know, it almost became selling without selling, as they say. Like, I never really had to sell myself after I reached that tipping point.
I guess it's a little bit like Hollywood. It's you know, once you have a script, let's say, that's been produced, now all of a sudden, oh, yeah, he's a scriptwriter, and he's good. You know, let's talk about a project with him. You know, so there's always a conversation involved, but you're not like some strange guy coming out of the woods. You know, you're a known quantity.
Yeah, and I think in the copywriting world, there's kind of this interesting distinction where you have a lot of serious copywriters who are very good at what they do, but you have many, many more hobbyists who may be doing it full-time, and they may actually be making a pretty good living, but they aren't kind of dedicated to the craft, and they don't love it the way that you are, you know, you're required almost to be living inside of copywriting to really break in at these top levels. And it can be very hard to distinguish between who those two groups of people are. Just on the surface, you know, if they send you a portfolio piece or they say, I'm a copywriter with 5 years experience and I've been looking at your business and I'd like to help you out, it can be very hard to distinguish between kind of the professionals and the hobbyists. So once you get known as a true professional, you know, people are going to be coming to you because they've already lost so much money hiring the hobbyists, unfortunately. That's kind of the way it works.
Well, yeah, let me throw in a sidebar here. There's 3 kinds of copywriters, and this is a gross generalization, but there's people that write for their own account. In other words, they've got their own business, and they happen to be writers too. And rather than hire copywriters, they write their own copy. And, you know, they get really powerful feedback about their quality of their own work, you know, because either their business will live or die based on their copy. And then there are people in your category who have proven yourself at the higher echelons of direct response business. You know, there was real companies doing real volume who, you know, they're not going to hire you twice because they like you. They're only going to hire you twice because your first piece was great, you know, or showed amazing promise, because you never know what's going to be to control or not. I mean, that's something we should get into in a bit. But they can just see, this guy knows what he's doing. This guy's serious. But then there's the 3rd category of copywriters, and I want to advise everybody to, you know, pay really close attention. There are a lot of people who are, you know, not that good, but they're very good at selling people on the idea that they're good, and they're very good at jacking up their fees and charging lots of money. I see this happen so often, Dan, in the entrepreneurial space. You know, someone doesn't have confidence in their own ability to write copy, and they've heard that they should get a copywriter, and they don't really know how to go about finding one, and then somehow they run across somebody who's got a great website, you know, is really good at blowing smoke, and next thing you know, they've written a $10,000 check to a guy who sends them back basically, you know, a template. Template type email, whatever, a template type sales letter that's really not that distinguished and really not going to do much. That happens a lot. There's kind of a warning to people that are out there buying copywriting services. You know, there are people who have proven track records, and that's really what you want. You don't want somebody just because they have a great website or because they've even appeared at lots of seminars. That really doesn't mean anything. What really matters is the kind of proven track record that they have. So those are the three kind of writers that I come across. So let's go back to you made these connections, you submitted your work. When they ask for an assignment, do they say we need something that's 16? Well, I don't know if they talk in terms of pages, right? Do they talk about word count, how long it needs to be, what kind of space they're trying to fill, or is it more open-ended? They give you a product and say just sell it.
It can be a little bit of both depending on the format that they're going to be putting it in. You know, for a lot of web-based sales pages and video sales letters, I've never received any sort of word cap. But if you're going to be doing something direct mail, they might say, yeah, this has to be 4 pages at the max because they're not going to pay to print it and mail it if it's any longer than that. But for the most part, I've gotten almost unlimited leeway in terms of what I can do as long as it fits within the brand, as long as it sells the product correctly, and as long as it's legally and factually correct. You know, you have a lot of creative liberties to come up with the big ideas and the formats and the structures that you want. And that goes back to the point that we were making about companies who value copywriters and who know the value that a copywriter can bring to them. They also know the value that a copywriter can bring to them when they allow that copywriter to, you know, roam freely within the confines of what they are actually allowed to publish.
Gotcha. So it makes sense in print. They kind of know what their constraints are. But online, you have a lot more flexibility. But let's take a video sales letter. Obviously, if you submit an 8-hour video sales letter, they're going to go, wait a minute. It's good, but...
Yeah, absolutely. I've never had that happen for the sole reason that I've never produced an 8-hour.
Well, I know, but you know what I mean.
And I guess, you know, that probably goes into some of the expertise of the copywriter that, you know, there's a judgment in how long or how in-depth you need to explain something. And, you know, you always want to explain it fully, but you never want to explain it more than you have to. And so my assumption is that when companies are hiring copywriters that they know have a track record, they're pretty safe in assuming that they're not going to go that off the rails.
Okay. And so you're writing web pages. You're also writing video sales letters. Sounds like you do some print. Are there any other mediums that you're writing for as well? Like do email follow-ups?
Yeah, tons of email and a lot of various internet advertising, whether it's on Facebook or various advertising platforms that show up around the internet in display or text. That's all, you know, there's unlimited distribution options once you get to a certain scale. And what we've been doing here at the company I'm working for now is just exploring the various distribution networks and things. And each one of those kind of has their own nuances in the copy and the creative that go out and the way that connects back to the sales letters and the advertorials and things like that. So I would say right now my distribution is probably, I probably work about 80% just writing long form sales pages, sales letters, and sales videos. That's all kind of one thing that I do, regardless of the format, that we approach it pretty much the same way. And then all that other stuff, email, ads, webinars, you name it, we'll test anything. So that kind of takes up the rest of the day. And that's actually really fun because it allows you to get real creative, think about what might work, what might not work. And in terms of learning about your customer, it's really fast, a really fast way to learn what your customer is responding to learn what people are clicking on, what they're spending time reading. Because, you know, these long-form sales letters, they take weeks, sometimes a month to produce. And so it's not exactly a great way to get feedback. It's a great way to get sales, but you have to be relatively assured of what the big idea and concepts behind those are going to be before you spend that those weeks and those months in the research and development of those campaigns. So we use a lot of these little ad platforms and email and content marketing type things, not only as ways to improve our sales funnel, but also as ways to rapidly iterate what we know about our customer.
Got it. So you might post a blog article somewhere on a certain theme and then track the number of clicks you get from that. And that tells you, oh, they're really interested in this. They really respond to this angle. Or conversely, wow, they didn't care. You know, they didn't even get to the bottom of it. And they didn't even bother to click.
Exactly. Exactly.
Wow.
You know, and sometimes you'd be surprised. The stuff that you thought was going to get a lot of engagement and a lot of clicks falls flat. And then you test it against an off-the-wall idea. And you see that that's actually what they really wanted all along.
Wow. Wow. And you know the great saying by Eugene Schwartz, which is, you know, you don't write copy, you assemble it. And this sort of feeds into that, right? You, in the method you're using, you put out a little piece here, a little piece there, and you just see, okay, what are they actually responding to? And then I imagine you take all those learnings and cobble them together, in the positive sense of the word, into, you know, a big battleship of a letter.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, from a business management standpoint, if you're managing a direct response business, it makes a lot of sense to put, even if you're spending money on clicks or spending money on content creation, it's going to be a lot less money than you're spending on the 8 weeks that it takes to put together a long-form sales letter that flops.
Right.
So I would think that it's an upfront cost that's almost invaluable in the amount of money that it can save you down the road.
So this would include maybe small articles within an email that goes to the house list. Is that an example of something that would be a short form thing that would be sort of used as sort of a testing device?
Yeah, absolutely. For some of the smaller clients I've worked with, the email list, the house email list becomes a two-way conversation. Absolutely start tracking the clicks that you're getting out of your various emails. You can ask for replies, surveys, and those things, especially if you have a business where you are the emailer, there's a certain amount of relationship and persona involved.
Mm-hmm.
You get a lot of really good feedback from the people who are on your list and who have been following you for some time, and they know you, they like you, they trust you, and they want to help you. And so explicitly you can ask them to fill out surveys, to respond, and then behind the scenes you can use your email services to track their clicks, engagement, and things like that. I think, you know, every asset you have, you should be leveraging. It's like Jay Abraham says, you know, getting everything you can out of all you've got.
Mm-hmm,
so if
mm-hmm.
you have a... I'm at the scale we're at, our email is too big for us to really do a lot of, you know, please reply and let us know what your biggest issues are, things like that. But we've used paid advertising and content and things like that to achieve the same goal.
Gotcha. And I've seen people, yeah, with smallish but growing businesses. I don't see many people do this, but it's a brilliant idea. And I think based on what you're saying, it would work great, which is that the email, it's like a weekly email that goes out, and it's all about answering the questions of the list members. You know, hey, yesterday or last week we talked about, you know, lifting barbells, you know, and somebody asked, well, what about the Bowflex machine? Well, that's what I'm going to talk about this week, you know, the pros and cons of the Bowflex machine. And the whole email newsletter was driven by an overt dialogue between the readers and this writer. And, of course, he gathered tremendous intelligence about what his readers were actually interested in and what they responded to.
Yeah, and that's actually something that I've seen. You can even automate that in a way, is by, if you have an autoresponder and someone opt-ins and they're getting automated emails towards the end of the sequence when you've identified them as a non-buyer, you can try and elicit one of those responses out of them that says, hey, I've been emailing you for 3 weeks now and you haven't responded, and I'm just wondering what's the number one reason why. And then you'll collect that data, assuming people respond, and then you might say, okay, the time commitment is the number one objection, and then you can go right back into your autoresponder, create a new email that sets expectations on how much time is going to be expected out of them after they make the purchase, and you've pretty much handled that objection.
Cool. Well, I'm gonna go on another sidebar related. I've been spending a lot of time studying the Silicon Valley startup culture. which, you know, for the longest time, what people did in Silicon Valley had no interest to me or any other direct response marketer at all, because they were just silly. They were just throwing money at the wall, and whatever stuck, they would run with it. And they didn't really have any, I didn't perceive a whole lot of smarts that could be transferred to small operators. Mm-hmm. Or even biggish operators. But that's really changed radically in the last, oh, I'd say 10 years. And the stuff that's coming out of Silicon Valley, especially in some of these startup schools, of which there are many, is pretty darn good. In fact, I don't want to go too far off the track, but it's pretty good. In fact, I think it even eclipses, to some extent, a lot of the entrepreneurial internet stuff that I see. In fact, I will say for a fact it does. But mm-hmm. Here's my point. One of the valued methods in starting a new business in Silicon Valley now, endorsed by the top seed venture capitalists, is for the founders to be really intensely involved with their customer, to the point that founders are expected to do customer, or they're strongly advised to do their own customer service. You know, don't farm it out in the early months. Really mm-hmm. get the brunt of the problems and the frustrations and the glitches and everything, so that you can smooth your business process out and get a greater and greater understanding of who it is you're actually creating your service for. I mean, this kind of close hands-on stuff is now considered state of the art in Silicon Valley for starting red hot startups. So it's kind of interesting that they're finally discovering that it's not just a bunch, because Google started with zero customer service. When they finally opened a customer service department for their advertisers 2 years ago, I almost fell off my chair. It's like, wow, this is amazing. I mean, you're actually going to answer our questions and provide us with some help? This is incredible. Anyway, yeah, this being in touch with your customers is where the success really is. Great. So we have a good sense of your career path, which is extremely logical. We have a good sense of what your assignments are like. We have a good sense of what the payday is, which is basically once you prove yourself as a serious writer, you're not going to be knocking on doors for work. You're actually going to be in an industry of people to whom you're a demand. You know, you're what they're looking for.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is a really nice position to be in. I mean, here we are in this, I think, objectively poor economy, and here's a profession where employers are anxious to find you, and you don't have to, go to school for 10 years to get some expensive degree. You know, if you have the will to learn and the will to do the work, you can write yourself right in. So let's talk about that part. Let's talk about how, because obviously it's not just a matter of networking and, following up on LinkedIn ads, you actually had to deliver the goods. So you read Dan's book, but I'm sure you did a lot more to bring yourself up to the point where you were an in-demand copywriter.
Yeah, this is what I really would love to talk about, because I'm very passionate about the art of copywriting, and that probably is maybe the number one thing, is you just have to fall in love with it. I think I told you this the last time we spoke. I study for an hour every morning before I get started on my writing. And, that's because I want to be a better writer, and I love it, and I actually enjoy that. You know, I look forward to that hour every day. And I just don't know how anybody could do this job if they didn't love it.
Right. It's not good enough. You can't just say, you can make a lot of money as a copywriter. That's just not enough motivation for someone to become a great copywriter. You have to really be fascinated by the whole process.
Yeah, and I think the part of that is that, I'm struggling for a way to word this, so I'll just say that it came to my mind, but being a copywriter is inherently being part failure. You're never going to hit everyone out of the park. If you hit half of them out of the park, you're going to be a legend.
Right.
So you have to kind of come to terms with this fact that your work, the product itself that you produce, and I'm using product to describe a campaign or a promotion, is not always going to be good. It's going to be good in the sense that you're a good copywriter and everything you produce is well-researched and well-executed, but it's not always going to be good in the sense that it works. And so you can't fall in love with the idea of selling a lot or being a great copywriter. You just have to fall in love with kind of the journey and the process of getting there and trying it and doing new things and always being hungry for more.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's not like an auto mechanic or a mace mason who builds walls, let's say, you know, you build a wall, you know, it's there. It's not going to collapse due to no fault of your own, right? If you're an auto mechanic and you put the right part in the right place and install it correctly, it's going to work. But, yeah, with direct response, we never, ever know what's going to happen until it hits the market. We have no clue.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's a razor's edge. There's good things about that, and then there's kind of the Malox moment, as we call it here at work, when you're just about to get published and you're going to sit on pins and needles for 3 days because we got to gather a sample size to see if it worked or not. But I guess kind of to get back to your original question and to fill in some of the details around that hour a day, the way that started was, you know, at the time I was relatively broke, essentially, because I was not making a lot of money off copywriting the first few months that I did it. And I knew I had to get better, but I didn't have the money to buy any of the $1,000 courses. I certainly didn't have the money to sit down once a week with a seasoned copywriter to be a cub or to get mentored. So I just started doing what a lot of the A-list copywriters recommend and what Gary Halbert recommended in his letter, which was I sat down and I hand-copied a proven successful ad for an hour every day. And that is a process that sticks with me to this day. A half hour of that hour that I spend every morning is doing that still.
That's just amazing. Wow.
It doesn't cost a thing, you know?
Wow. You know, I have to confess, I never did that. And yet when Gary Halbert says that he recommends it, that he recommended it, and I've heard people who say they've done it, and now here you're saying you've done it, and you really, obviously, you think very highly of that method because you devote half of your training time every day to just that. How does it work, or is it just something that can't be explained? Why do you think it makes you a better writer, a better copywriter in particular?
I think there's a couple things to it. You know, the first thing is that on sort of a technique, actual writing basis, you're going through and you're physically writing out greatly constructed sentences, and it just starts to kind of permeate into your subconscious, and you start to write better. I think the other thing is that as you're developing as a copywriter, you need to develop your own style and your own voice, and I've heard some people say, against the hand copying technique, that what you're doing is you're stifling yourself because you're forcing yourself to learn in somebody else's voice. But I found the exact opposite to be true, that, you know, if I took a handful of great ads from Bensavenga and Schwartz and Halbert, I was able to create a voice that was uniquely mine, but that kind of stood on the shoulders of the great stuff that they were writing and allowed what was great about their writing to influence the development of that voice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you write by hand, right? This, you know, you don't type this stuff, right?
No, it's all by hand on loose leaf paper. And actually, that's kind of the final evolution of this process that I've gone through. And I think what might be actually the most significant is what I'll do now is when I finish handwriting the ad, I'll go back. And then if everything's written in black, I'll take a red pen or a green pen, and I'll go through and I'll annotate it, and I'll kind of do a little case study on it myself. And I'll say, okay, this section, what was he trying to do here? What was the objection that he was preempting, or the value proposition of the product that he brought it up at this point? Why? I'll do that on kind of a strategic level, and then I'll go in and I'll think about why they use certain bits of proof and specific language. And so then it not only becomes a subconscious activity in the hand copying itself, you're kind of bridging that subconscious into an actual conscious exercise of really trying to think through the strategy and the techniques that were used in that particular piece of copy.
Wow.
And I think that, for me, has been a revelation every time I finish an ad and go back to the beginning and then go through it in my own mind. It just really helps bring all of those things into my own writing, into my own voice, and into my own consciousness while I'm writing. You know, I think a lot of times there's so many things to consider in copywriting that you tend to forget about a lot of them. And
right.
So the more that you can put yourself in a position to actually be able to call upon the knowledge that you've gained, the better off you're going to be. You know, you're not going to overlook something or accidentally forget a crucial element that you needed to include.
Mm-hmm. It makes a lot of sense. Because actually, come to think of it, how else are you really going to plumb the depths of a great sales letter? You can read it, and that's good. You can read it a couple of times. That's better than not reading them, obviously. But there's no surer way or deeper way to become intimate with a piece of writing than to copy it out by hand. Let's face it. I mean, there's just no other way. And I love that second step of going back over it and identifying the techniques and the forces and the elements that they're using within a letter. Wow.
Yeah, and I mean, that was kind of, like I said, I didn't have the money to sit down with a mentor once a week. And, you know, there's no doubt in my mind if you have the money to do that. And right now I'm fortunate enough to have a brilliant copy chief who I get to talk to every day. And I'm learning at an exponential rate right now, but I didn't have those resources available to me. So the next best thing was kind of thinking through, okay, if the guy who wrote this ad was sitting here with me, what would he say about it? What would he say about why he did that or why he didn't do that? And what, you know, how would he answer this question of mine? So, you know, you just kind of got to use the resources that are available to you with what you have.
Yeah. Well, that's another benefit of breaking into copywriting at a professional level where you're working in the industry. You can get access, in your case, to really seasoned hands. And that's something that the average person or the average aspiring copywriter doesn't have access to unless they find a good mentor that they can hire. But that used to be, you know, pre-internet. It's interesting. The internet's really done a lot of things for copywriting. First, it exponentially increased the size of the market. There was never a time when people were going out and hiring copywriters or, you know, regular businesses. That was a fairly rare thing, but that became more and more acceptable as the web became important, content became more important. And now the second phase is using the web to generate ideas that you can then turn into sales letters, and then using the web to prospect so that you can become, you know, get access or gain entry into a professional copywriting situation. But in the old days, again, pre-internet, that was how people learned. They would get it, not quite knowing what copywriting was, they'd get a job as an ad writer, and next thing they knew, their boss, if they were lucky, was a copy chief. And he was, you know, saying, no, don't do it that way. Try it this way, and here's why. And that piece has really been missing. But you're right. If you read enough books and you handwrite the letters, and which is going to put you really in touch with that letter, then you have the beginning, at least, of the capacity to go through that letter and see what's in it. It's not just words on the page. You know, it's really all strategy, as far as I can see. You know, every sentence, every paragraph, every word really is a strategic decision or a tactical decision.
Yeah, and I think you just brought up an important point there about you have to have some knowledge, obviously, to make that a worthwhile exercise. So, you know, you kind of fill in the holes with what you don't understand by going back and reading the classic text, reading breakthrough advertising and tested advertising methods, learning from the master, so to speak, so that the next time you hand copy an ad and you go through it and something doesn't make sense, you can immediately go back, you reference those texts, and, you know, that light bulb's going to go off. And it's just going to be a brand, you know, sometimes the smallest things can have the biggest impact. I remember just one quick example that Gary Halbert had a letter where he was talking about the value of being very ultra-specific. And, you know, just a small lesson, but that's one of the most powerful things you can bring to your copy is being specific in what you name and numbers you use and facts that you cite. And immediately after reading that, I would be hand-copying an ad, and you know, it's like all of these specific things are just leaping off the page all of a sudden that I hadn't really noticed before.
Mm. Yep, makes perfect sense. And let me ask you this. Gary Halbert letters, even though they're newsletters, are really brilliant copy in their own right.
Oh, yeah. And very entertaining. You know,
yeah.
An education and an entertaining lesson all in one.
Yep, and then he's also selling you on Gary Halbert, which I think is the ultimate aim of all of his copywriting.
Oh yeah, I think the ultimate thing that Gary Halbert accomplished was creating the persona that he was the best ever. You know, he was very good at creating his own image, and here I am talking about him well after he's passed away. So obviously, it worked.
So let's talk about two things, some of the books that you read or that you think of. You already mentioned them, but let's go through them again because it's really an important subject. And then whose letters you actually copy, whose writing you actually hand copy. So in books you mentioned tested advertising methods, which I by the way, fourth edition or earlier, the newest edition is a little bit silly. It's changed. It's been improved.
Yeah, I think that's the one I have. I've heard that. I think the one I have is the one with the red cover, and I think that's the one that got a little bit modified. So I'm going to have to go back and pick up.
Oh, you don't have the – it's the one that I recommend is it's the white back. It's a picture of him on the cover. It's published by usually by Reward Books, and it's got red type, and it's tested advertising methods, fourth edition.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd
have to go check to see which one I have. I don't remember what edition it is, but around here at the company I work at, that book is kind of the first thing they toss on your desk. They say you got to learn everything in here.
Gotcha.
And then after that comes probably Breakthrough Advertising.
And then there's, you know, a guy, and I'm drawing a blank. I can't believe I can't remember the guy's name. He was around in the 40s. He wrote so many ads. He wrote the ads for, in fact, I think he actually wrote, believe it or not. I think he really wrote Win Friends and Influence People. But he definitely wrote the ad for it. He's the guy that went out.
Was that Victor Schwab?
Exactly. I think
yeah,
people
I
haven't
read that one. How to Write a Good Advertisement. That's another one that I got to get to.
That's amazing. Here you are. You know, you're an established copywriter, getting better all the time, and there are still great books out there for you to read. No, I would recommend that one really highly. He was an extremely savvy guy. I even think he might have written It's Gary recommends it, and I recommend it, and Marty Ellison recommends it. I'm drawing a blank on the title, but How I Raised Myself from a Success
Frank
to Failure. Yeah, I think Frank told him his story, and I think Schwab wrote that book. You might enjoy that experiment. Read Schwab's ads, and then read those two books. They really sound like they're all coming from the same guy. And I know he wrote the ad also for How I Raised Myself from a Failure to Selling. So that's just fascinating. So your proof that one or two solid books, and by the way, Breakthrough Advertising and Tested Advertising Methods, I mean, you don't need more, you know, more good
stuff.
Yeah,
and that's a great point because, you know, I've only read a handful of these books, but I'm confident that I've extracted huge amounts of the knowledge out of them and been able to apply it because I go through, I'm not trying to, you know, win any awards for the most books that have been read on copywriting. So it doesn't do me any good to go through a book really quickly and say, oh yeah, I read that one and I read that one and I read that one. In my mind, it's only worthwhile if I read it and then I'm actually able to bring it to my work. So I go through these books very slowly. Again, I take handwritten notes. And then when I finish the book, I go back into those handwritten notes and I type up a one or two page or condensed summary, depending on how long the book is, that I can quickly refer to. So then I kind of have, you know, almost a system for referencing back into these books where if it's something that will probably only take me 2 or 3 minutes, I can go right back into the Word document that I created that's a super condensed version of the book, find it. If it's not there, then I go back into my own handwritten notes. And then if I still can't find it in my own handwritten notes, then I can go back and page through the book. So that's a very lengthy process, but it almost is watertight in that I'm never going to miss anything in any of those books when I'm working out with some of my own work.
Well, you know, it's really interesting what you're describing because I never really thought of this before, but I know it's true from my own experience. Copywriting is a watertight profession. In other words, if you're going to be a good copywriter, you're not the kind of person that can gloss over things or good enough is good enough. And this is one of the hardest things to convey when you teach people copywriting or try to explain what copywriting is. The intensity of focus and the attention to detail is really intense. This is not a casual, I'll just toss something off when I'm in a good mood kind of profession to be in.
The more talented the other copywriters you're being tested against or the more sophisticated and jaded the market that you're selling to is, you know, the less corners you can cut, and there's certainly very, very little room for being lazy.
So the mystery of how you went from zero to a control-beating writer at a major you know, direct response company is a little bit less of a mystery now to me because now I see your work methods, and these work methods are obvious. They're going to generate positive results for anybody who applies them, and very few people do. And I'm really glad you made the point that you know, if you don't have money, you can still do this. Like, no one's holding you back or blocking you from being a great copywriter. The great books are out there. You make the point that it's better to read one or two of them at great depth than to, you know, be in the I've read 100 copywriting books contest. And also obviously identifying good copy, which you'll be able to do once you've read one or two good books, being able to identify good copy and then just giving yourself the time every day to write it out in hand. I'm getting it now. It's not a magical thing. It's not a superstition. Oh, if you write other people's copy by hand, you'll be a great copywriter. No, if you apply that kind of intense focus on what greats were doing, and this applies, by the way, like I think of musicians. You know, there's every musician I know. You know, I know a lot of jazz musicians, and when they were younger, they all learned their favorite musician's solos note for note. Now, did that hurt their creativity? Obviously not. It all went into amazing directions. But it got them to really tune up their mind and really focus on a brilliant piece so that they could think about, just like you're doing. You know, in order to learn a solo, you've got to really listen. You've got to play it back identically. And to do that, you have to develop a sense of the structure of the solo. Otherwise, you can't memorize it. That would be a really interesting test. Probably you don't need to do it, but, you know, to memorize a great sales letter.
That'd be something.
So you've mentioned some of the letters some of the writers whose letters you've copied. Let's say them again, just for people who might have missed it the first time. Whose ads do you think are worthy of copying, and where do you get these ads to copy them?
Well, I'm a big Ben Savanga fan these days. He's probably 90% of the stuff that I copy. And his stuff can actually be kind of hard to get your hands on. Some good Google skills and some people in the right places who can send you the ads helps out, certainly. But for, you know, the other legendary copywriters, Ogilvy, Halbert, Schwartz, Victor Schwab, honestly, I would just start by doing a search of the world's greatest copywriters, get a list of their names, and then, you know, you can Google and find their stuff on the internet. There's a couple good blogs that post occasional ads. There's forums where people will talk about it. And the other thing to do is just go into the Gary Halbert letter. He has the one issue. I think it's called something along the lines of On Getting Experience or something like that. That's where he talks about the ads that he would recommend somebody hand copy and the books that he would recommend somebody read if they're first getting started.
Gotcha. And that's online. We're so lucky to have that. Another gift of the internet. All the Gary Halbert lists.
That's a priceless gift. Completely free. And, you know, some of the best direct marketing knowledge you can find anywhere.
Absolutely. It's amazing that probably the two best copywriters, in recent decades were both named Gary. It's just a strange coincidence. But they were very different personalities for sure. However, if you read their copy, a lot of people think Gary Halbert is a wild man, just, just writing crazy stuff. But when you actually read his writing, boy, it is honed down, it is bare bones, it is clean, it is smooth. I'm drawing a blank at the right way to describe it. But it really, it just seems like
I would
normal.
Call it electrifying.
You'd call it electrifying, but not because he's throwing exclamation points around or using, you know, $10 words. It's more...
No, but it just because it lights you up inside to read what he's writing. It's just so brilliantly powerful, and it just, you know, you can't help but sit up straight and pay attention to every word. And, you know, even that kind of thought process has helped me think about the process of writing copy, is actually thinking about the physical motions that somebody is making when they're reading your copy. You know, is this something that's going to cause them to sit straight up and lean forward, or are they just going to be kind of perusing the page, bored, looking for an excuse to throw it away or click out of it or hit the delete button?
Gotcha.
It's kind of the universal, you got to think about the universal reactions of people who read your copy.
Right. I always say that Gary Halbert is the master of the wind-up, especially when in his public speaking. You know, he'll start on this little preamble, And, you know, it may take 5 minutes or 10 minutes. But the whole preamble is getting you ready to hear the real story, to hear the story. You have to find these, but once you find them, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. And I would recommend to our listeners, definitely study Gary Halpert's stuff and notice how what a genius he was at introducing a topic or what I call winding up or writing a preamble. By the time he's ready to start telling his story, you think it's the most important story that anybody's ever told. So great. So your method, while not easy, sounds simple, and again, I'm stressing it's not easy, but it's simple in that get one or two of the great books, and pretty much everybody's in agreement that Eugene Schwartz and John Caples, and I've thrown Vic Schwab, but apparently you only need two, but, have a small core of books, read the hell out of them. Don't just read from them, consciously extract. So that's what you really did. You didn't really read them. You were like a miner digging into the earth and pulling out the ore and refining it and, smelting it or whatever it is they do this to metal, and then shaping it and putting it in categories, and so, which is a whole different process than just simply reading or skimming. So you did that.
I encourage anybody who is going on some sort of learning endeavor, whether it's copywriting or anything, is that, you can take what I said today or what somebody else says about how they've developed and use that as kind of the 80% solution to get started on. But I think it's important to always be refining these proven, if you call them methods, with your own individual nuances. A lot of this stuff that I've thrown on top of handwriting is because it suits me. It may not suit somebody else. And so I think it's really important to find your process and then never be dogmatic about changing it. I'm always kind of refining these things in real time and improving them and trying new things out. And that applies to the process of writing copy too, the process that I use when I start a promotion and I'm gathering information on the product and developing the logical flow of the argument. All of that is a living, breathing animal. It changes every time I write a new promotion, and it's always getting better. And I think that's super important, is that having that process kind of codified, but in a way that it's always changing and improving, just helps everything get better with time. And eventually you're going to reach this point where those marginal improvements, 1% of 100 is only 1%, but when you multiply that times 1,000, then every 1% gain is adding a lot to what you're doing.
Gotcha. And, to bring this full circle, makes the things that Gary Bencivenga chose to speak about at the Titans meeting, it just brings it into sharper focus. Because, again, those of you that were there know, but those that weren't, a large percentage, he finally did get down to the point where he was, sharing craft secrets, but a huge proportion of his presentation was really about developing your mind and developing your, even spirit on a certain level, you could even say, that this is not a mechanical job, it's not a, insert a screw and turn the wrench, it's not that kind of work. It's the kind of work that requires the most of you and the best of you. And that's by definition going to be an ongoing process. You really get the sense when he was talking that he's still doing all this stuff. Like he's still, keeping his lens clear and his vision wide and his mind on target. Which reality, that's a fact of life. That you just can't, there's no such thing as, maybe if you're and even farming, you can't really coast. But, there really is no profession where you're going to have any degree of success at if you're just in coasting mode. It's just, it's not going to happen. Maybe you should work at the post office. I mean, not to say take anything away from anybody that works at the post office, but, there are certain jobs where you can coast, where you can just, learn it and just, keep doing it. But copywriting is clearly not one of them. In fact, it sounds like it's one of the great challenges out there for anybody that wants to use their mind to its fullest.
Yeah, I actually just had that same discussion with another copywriter here today. We were talking about how copywriting is essentially an endless journey, and that goes back to what I said at the beginning of the call. You have to enjoy the journey because you're never going to get to the destination. There's nobody, Gary Bencivenga included, who knows everything there is to know about human persuasion and marketing and influence and applied psychology. And if you want, it's something that you can continue discovering and digging into every day for the rest of your life.
And then on a practical note, this is a very valuable skill to have in this world. Because as I pointed out earlier, you know, we're in technically and I think objectively a down economy. This is not a boom time where employers are dying for employees. It's kind of the opposite. Employees really have to fight hard to find jobs these days. And here's a profession where if you lay the groundwork, simple stuff, not easy, but simple stuff that doesn't have to cost you money, will cost you time, will cost you energy. But if you're willing to do the groundwork and do outreach and, you know, put yourself on the line, you can get to a point where employers are, they're after you. Yeah. So
I think if you're passionate about it and you're willing to put the time in, the sky's the limit. You know, I think I mentioned this to you that I've only been doing this for a little bit more than 2 years, and I've had some decent amount of success, I suppose. And I know that I'm just beginning to scratch the surface of where I can let this career take me, where I can let this passion for writing and persuasion take me. It's an incredible time.
Great. Great. Well, Dan, thank you so much for sharing your experience with us. I hope that we filled in some important blanks that are often missing from discussions of copywriting. And I think you've revealed some absolutely accessible tools that are available to anybody regardless of their financial situation. And that's encouraging. You know, last thing you want to hear is, oh, my God, it's going to cost me a fortune to get in the door. No, this is something where passion will take you there. You've also laid out a really, you know, intelligent, straightforward path for how you grow one step at a time in the industry, and how to take your improving skills and present them at higher and higher levels. We never talked about what a control is. You know, maybe we'll end there because this is kind of where the rubber meets the road. What is a control, and what does it mean to be a control, and why is it so significant?
Okay, so a control is any piece of marketing or advertising that is currently working in the marketplace. So right now my company has our biggest pulling ad is our control, and that's where we send the majority of our traffic to. It's what we mail to. And my whole job, essentially, is to write something that does better than that.
Gotcha. Because that's going to mean greater profits and for the company.
Yeah, and it can be hard because, obviously, that ad has worked so well that, you know, you really have to be on point to get something new that works better. And one part of that, obviously, is being a technically sound copywriter and being able to write a letter that is as well executed as the control. But I think a bigger part of that is identifying the big idea or the strategy that you're going to use that's going to take what the consumer is seeing in the current control and give them something that's even better, you know, something where they are even more in tune with the message that you're giving them. And that's really where the hard work comes. You know, we spend weeks researching new ideas and coming up with big ideas before we even put pen to paper, because that's 80% of the battle is just having the right message.
And this is a necessity for these companies because they know very well that eventually their controls will wear out and that the market's always changing. And if they're not continually trying to beat their own successes, they're going to run out of creative juice. So rather than find themselves in that situation and be behind the curve, they're always working to be ahead of the curve, which involves employing people like you to, you know, try to craft and build a better mousetrap.
Yeah, absolutely. I forget who he was interviewing with, but Brian Kurtz said something in an interview I was listening to recently where he said, and Brian Kurtz is the executive vice president at Boardroom for people listening who might not be aware of who he is. Anyway, he said, he never understood they had this industry award in the direct marketing industry for the longest standing control. And that always was kind of an oxymoron to him because he said whenever they had a new control, they would have a short victory speech essentially, and then that control became the enemy. And then the whole job of the company was to produce something that did better.
You know, and for people that I don't know, Boardroom Bottom Line, you know, is one of the great direct mail publishers of all time. The founder, Marty Edelstein, was inducted into the Hall of Direct Marketing Hall of Fame. And this Titans event, which I referenced a couple of times in this call, was basically a memorial a year later to him, a tribute to him. And his status, his the regard that people held him in the direct response business was so high that people like Dan Kennedy and Greg Renker and Jay Abraham and Joe Sugarman and Gary Bensavenga and others just, you know, dropped everything and said, yeah, we'll be there. We'll speak. I mean, no one's ever been able to get this particular group of people together under one roof ever before.
Phenomenal event, once in a lifetime. I was so happy to be there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Gary is the most elusive of all. He gave one seminar several years ago when he retired from, you know, the mainstream, and now he's got his own business. But after decades of just beating control after control, he gave one seminar, and that was it. And this was only his second public appearance teaching his stuff. So when the people at Boardroom have a strategy, and their strategy was celebrate beating the control and then turn the control into your worst enemy, pay attention. they you know, this is not a company that, you know, that just sprouted up last year. They've been doing this the 70s, and I don't know what their revenue is these days, and I don't know what their employee number is, but they used to basically make $100 million a year with 100 employees. You know,
that's phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, that's great. That's just nuts, right? You know, one of the great, and privately owned, and, you know, no stock market shenanigans, just a real company making real money, selling real products to real people. Beat the control, beat your own control, don't rest on your laurels, and that's what copywriting is all about. Well, Dan, thank you. I think we've shed a lot of light on this subject for people that are curious about copywriting or in the middle of their training or maybe even further along their training and they're trying to get new inspiration, new insight, to how to go to the next level. And I think you've shared a lot. I'm going to copy some stuff myself, actually. You've really inspired me.
That's great.
Yeah, I thank you for that. And remember, when we say copy, we're talking about by hand, not a word processor, by hand. Great, Dan. So we will be in touch, and I want to thank you again for the time, and see you around the Internet.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really hope that your listeners found this useful, and I really had a pleasure doing it.